Today on Inside the Black Box, we're talking with Lauren Williams, director of the NASA Center for Ribosomal Origin and Evolution, or is it Origins?
Origins, plural.
Origins, plural, and evolution, with updates on some previous shows we've done with him on the origin of life. And is it safe to say it's kind of the chemical origin of life? Or is that redundant?
That is redundant.
Because life's got to come from chemicals.
It's just complicated chemistry.
Life is complicated chemistry. I've learned something.
That's the definition of life.
Is it really?
Very, very complicated chemistry.
Is this something you read in a T-shirt, or you actually, you know, this is written down in a scholarly tome?
I made it up. But it is a very good definition.
Okay, so we've learned just because you made it up doesn't mean it's not true.
That's exactly right.
But if you make it up, it's not necessarily science unless you can actually, you know, do some proving of this, which will actually be relevant to our science in the news. We'll save that as a teaser for later. But updates on the origins of life coming up next on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
Catch a slice of Atlanta radio history, repackaged and re-aired for your convenience every Tuesday at 7 p.m. right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta. The Underground Recordings features historical wreck footage from as far back as the late 1960s, as well as complete live at wreck studio performances, which have been preserved from the mid-1980s on. And you can relive those seminal recordings, like this one from William Carlos Williams, recorded November 12, 1996, all courtesy of the Underground Recordings. That's the Underground Recordings, every Tuesday night at 7 p.m., right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
Hello. Hi. Do you want to go to a party with me? No, the game's on. Oh, I almost forgot. I'll be right there.
We like sports and we don't care who knows. From shooting hoops to the Super Bowl. We like sports and we don't care who knows.
Football, tennis, hockey.
We like sports, and we care that you know. That's the Ramblin' Rec Report, 6 o'clock on Wednesdays. We'll talk football, basketball, softball, baseball, you name it. We have it. That's the Ramblin' Rec Report, 6 o'clock on Wednesdays, here on WREK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly radio program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and we have no idea where today's guest co-host, Steve Harvey, is. But nonetheless, we will soldier on with our guest talking about updates on the origins of life. Lauren Williams, professor of chemistry here in the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry. Is that what it is? Chemistry and biochemistry?
It's together, yes.
Okay. At the Georgia Institute of Technology. He did his PhD in physical chemistry at Duke, did postdoctoral work at Harvard in pharmacology, at MIT in biology, and now is the director of the NASA Center for Ribosomal Origins and Evolution. So welcome to the program, dude.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And let's begin the program, as we often do, with our favorite segment.
Science in the News.
All right, and today we're going to be a little controversial.
I'm nervous.
Are you really?
A little bit.
All right, you're not going to get too emotional about this because you are a calm, cool, collected scientist, right?
I'm a scientist. That's all redundant. Science, calm, cool, collected, all go together.
I've met some hothead scientists. I'm not sure that's necessarily redundant. But nonetheless, we're going to try to stay away from the political side of Senate candidate from Missouri, Aiken, Todd Aiken, who actually made a claim that many, many candidates for office have made over about the last 10 years, right? That for some reason, the pregnancy rates resulting from sexual assault in women, right? Pregnancy rates from rape are essentially non-existent, right? And we're not going to take the emotional side, right? Because the emotional side would look at the politics of this, and a lot of people want to push, you know, no exceptions for abortion in the case of rape and incest and things like that. And there would be a political reason why they would like to push this point. That we're not going to talk about. We're simply going to talk about the science of it, right?
The science.
Yeah, and the point is they base their science on the assumption that in a sexual assault, the biological, you know, environs, right? The biology of conception is different than when it's consensual, right?
That's right.
Yeah, but and it's not a completely absurd idea to suggest that the pregnancy rates are dependent on the conditions in which conception occurred, right? In fact, doctors have done studies on this for years.
That's correct.
Okay, right. And in fact, you know, what I like to point out is my colleagues in the infertility community often point out that the conditions of conception affect the pregnancy rates. And we've had all sorts of different issues on this. For example, studies have shown that if you do an artificial insemination where it's not in vitro, it's actually, you know, in the womb, right? It's a normal kind of inception, that there are certain, you know, mixtures of buffer solutions with enzymes that can actually make sperm a little peppier. That's a commonly used thing by these reproductive biologists. And they've got studies that show that. And there's a reason for it, right? These enzymes have a biochemical effect on this. But for many, many years, and this was decades ago, they actually believed that if women climaxed, it increased pregnancy rates. And then they found out that really wasn't true. It's really irrelevant as to whether or not that happens, or at least it wasn't statistically significant. But as someone who likes to make jokes about these in front of large groups of nurses at infertility conferences, it makes for a lot of really good jokes. So the point is, you know, this is something you can actually study. And a lot of these folks refer to a essay. I'm going to call it an essay because it is not a peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Right. It's not a technical report.
Yeah. It's an essay by John C. Wilkes, MD. I actually found it reprinted. It's reprinted all over the place. It was written in April 1999, where he actually goes through some basic statistics and tries to prove that pregnancy rates are of order 0.2 or 0.3% from forcible rapes. And that's what a lot of people reference. And if you actually look through the paper, he's got some very nice statistics on the number of rapes that occur in the United States in two different years, things from the Bureau of Census. But at some point, there's that figure where you cite something, or you mention something, and the entire thesis of the paper hangs on it, right? For the business folks listening, you know, it's that section in the business plan where you say, after 10 years, we'll have X percent of the market. Right. And you have no way of knowing that. You kind of assume it. And everyone says, oh, we'll have 20% of the market after 10 years. And I think only Compact Computer had that or something like that. It's a ridiculously high number. And somewhere in there, after he cites all this information about rape, he points out that now for the important question. Indeed, it is. How many rape pregnancies are there? The answer is that according to statistical reporting, there are no more than one or two pregnancies resultant from every 1,000 forcible rapes. So that's 0.1 or 0.2%. There is no reference on that. There is no logic on that. He goes down and lists about 8 different assumptions to try to get there, but there simply is no experimental measurement of this sort of thing. And I think at that point, if you were reviewing this paper, that's when you say, look, you can't publish this stuff. You need to back that up. And the logic below it doesn't even come close. And you'd return it. And someone said, oh, yeah, you know, we got 3 references and we would put those in there. And then you'd send it back. And then it would go back and forth until, and let's be honest, would you describe peer review as a perfect system?
No, it's not peer. It's the most perfect system we have.
Yes. I think it can be quite flawed.
Although it can be highly flawed. For example, my last paper, it was highly flawed when that paper was rejected.
We all say that. The last paper I just sent in fact, I've got 3 papers I'm working on that were rejected that I need to resend in. And we often say, well, this is what you say. Did you even read this paper?
Exactly. The third reviewer. It's always the third reviewer.
Yeah, exactly. There's always one or two guys that, oh, yeah, this is good. You know, you should clarify figure 3 and add some more, you know, notation about this. You know, clarification. And that's good because it makes your paper better. And then there's all one guy that's, you know, this is crazy. It's, you know. So, so it's just, it's ridiculous junk science. I mean, it is an essay.
There's no reviewer who would accept this as legitimate science.
And so the point is, you can look at whatever articles you want. There's some interesting ones in the Atlantic Monthly and in the Washington Post just on the 20th of this month alone that cite a lot of interesting studies. And the one study I found that was probably the most rigorous, and it really was more of a psychological study. So it was published in Volume 14, Issue 1, Page 1 of Human Nature by Jonathan Gottschall and Tiffany A. Gottschall from St. Lawrence University. And it's what I might describe as a meta study. I just like the word meta. I think it's cool. So meta means something about something, right? So that's the, you know, so metadata is data that describes data. A meta study is a study of other studies. So they actually took some very interesting data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and other sources and actually analyzed this. And here they clearly state their assumptions. For example, that they can't necessarily normalize on a per incident basis for birth control. Right, because the study didn't say, are you on birth control? And then you said whether or not you were raped and whether or not it resulted in a pregnancy. They actually studied 405 different women that were sexually assaulted. And their conclusion is that their pregnancy rates are higher than in the general population. So the general population typically is between 1% and 3%. They said a lot of interesting studies on that. They claim the pregnancy rate for this group of rape victims was more than 6%. And they claim it's statistically significant. They did a T-test for comparison. And I will say this, I haven't looked enough into the thing to figure out how they did a T-test. Because a T-test requires multiple measurements. So it depends how they broke it up into multiple measurements, right? But at least a T-test uses the normal distribution to sort of figure out what are the likelihoods of these being randomly from the sort of the same population. So the point is, there are assumptions in there. You can pick on the assumptions, but it is a much more well-organized study. And even if you disagree with their conclusion that pregnancy rates are higher among rape victims, you are really hard-pressed to make the claim that, pregnancy rates among rape victims are negligible.
The close legitimate to rape was the phrase that
don't
was
even
used.
Get me started on that one. Okay. Yeah, I mean, and I'll be honest with you. It's junk science. We don't want to go too much into the political issues of this, but it has to be politically motivated.
Well, but I wouldn't call it junk science even. I would call it theology.
So it's not even bad.
It's not even bad science.
Bad science, and then there's something that's not even science.
It's not even science.
Okay.
Right.
And by calling it theology, we'll get a million phone calls and say, well, you're picking on religion now.
Well, the idea is that the conclusions are already ordained,
yes.
And then
right.
The facts are organized around to support those conclusions. And I mean, that's not science. That has nothing to do with science.
Right, and that is the take-home message.
That's exactly it. Right. And you can see it with the evolution debate. You can see it with human sexuality. You can see exactly that same pattern repeated over and over again.
Right, but so you're trying to make an assumption, make the facts fit the data, really to turn back the clock to the good old days of 1950, 1940. One thing I will say, I address this both in discussions with my technical colleagues and with my comedian friends. Who's against birth control? Okay, the Pope is, right? He's the head of that group. He's got to, you know. But, I mean, you're a parent. I'm a parent.
There are many people who are opposed to birth control.
I just never understood why.
If you believe that a fertilized egg is a legitimate human being, then you must be opposed to many kinds of birth control, which just prevent implantation of fertilized eggs, for example.
And you're right. That is, so the whole in vitro fertilization industry where my wife works would go down the toilet.
Well, yeah, but a lot of birth control also. Basically, the birth control that prevents implantation. Eggs are fertilized.
Right.
And so that, if you believe that a fertilized egg is a worthy human being on the value of your 8-year-old child, then that's
But there are people that believe I'm not a legitimate human being. and would like to, you know, maybe cross me out as well. I don't know.
Yeah, I've experienced that.
Yeah. Okay. So we're not going to get into that one. So let's jump from this very controversial topic to another one that's almost equally as controversial, right?
We see some of the same arguments.
Yeah. Exactly. There. And exactly. All right. Trent's telling me we got to take a break. Is it already 19 minutes after? All right. So we will take a break, and when we come back, we will be talking with Lauren Williams about the origin of life, right? Not the origin of species and necessarily evolution, but really how the whole thing started. Even more controversial, if you ask me, than what Darwin did.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's even more controversial. So this should be exciting. And given the fact that it is controversial, and I think we've been unemotional so far, right? You haven't jumped up and down and ranted and raved, and neither have I.
You've done well.
If people have an interesting question, no matter what side of the debate you're on, and you want to call in, and you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to one with a question or comment, by all means do so. Our number here is 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WRAK Atlanta. Emory University Department of Psychiatry is now conducting a government-sponsored study of FDA-approved treatments for depression. The study is designed specifically for people who have never been treated for depression before. It includes 6 months of treatment and a full psychiatric evaluation. Every person in the study receives either an FDA-approved medicine or talk therapy. No placebos or experimental medicines are used in this study. For more information, call 404-778-6663. That's 404-778-6663. Or you can go to emoryclinicaltrials.com.
For the chillest waves on your up and down, tune into Gold Sounds every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Only on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box. So before we get started into the origin of life on this fine planet, our whole science of the news thing, right, basically dealing with, you know, even assumptions and possible shortcomings in the study from St. Lawrence University that we mentioned before, it's not that big of a deal because, as we pointed out, you really can't do a controlled study on this because the NIH rules would preclude you from actually sexually assaulting people. And you wouldn't have to, right? Because, I mean, the point we were trying to make is if they are statistically different between conception that's consensual and not consensual, is it half, is it a quarter, is it double? Doesn't really matter.
It does occur.
And recent statistics, I think it was last year, actually said it was over 30,000 pregnancies that result from sexual assault. So that's all the significance you need. Some studies are not worth doing. That is a fair statement
to say.
That's
exactly right. We don't need to know the specific numbers on this.
But this meta study that we mentioned from St. Lawrence University does provide sufficient insight to conclude that what people are claiming in the political arena now is, what's the technical word? Hooey? Can I use that? Would that be?
Hooey is a good word.
All right, we agree on hooey. Okay, hooey. So now... onto the origin of life, and we didn't even prepare notes on this, so tell us about the center, the NASA Center.
Okay, yeah, we have a $7 million NASA Center here at Georgia Tech that involved quite a few professors in engineering, biology, chemistry, and we study molecules in the way that paleontologists study fossils. In fact, we call them molecular fossils.
Okay.
And you and me and bacteria and archaea are full of fossils, molecular fossils, that date back from before the origin of life. So there is, just like the rock record allows us to study dinosaurs, mm-hmm. the molecular record allows us to study the origin of life.
So what you're claiming, and this is something we've talked about on previous programs, we had Nick Hudd in here who studies some similar sorts of things here in your department as well. Molecules can evolve.
Oh, molecules can evolve, that's for sure. In fact, evolution does not require life. I mean, we can do evolution among molecules in a test tube. In fact, the origin of life most certainly involved evolution of molecules in what we would call an abiotic process.
Okay, abiotic, meaning without biology.
Yeah, so okay. Molecules started evolving before anything approached what we would consider biology.
Right, and you almost contended before we started the program. Is there a continuum between molecules and the really complicated chemistry that you call life?
Yeah, there is a... Yeah, if you... in all the scenarios, molecular and chemical scenarios and models for the origin of life, there is really no... There's no bright line between living and non-living. You can never... Mm-hmm. It's a continuum.
Right.
Basically, increasing complexity. There's certain characteristics that changed over time, but to actually say, here you had a non-living system and then some abrupt change into a living system, that's just not a correct way to think about it.
Okay. Yet people try to do that anyway.
Yeah, people would like to think that there is some kind of stardust that landed or some magical moment that. Where there was an instantaneous sort of process and all of a sudden you have life. But that's not really right. A reasonable chemical way to think about the origin of life.
Right. And in fact, in chemistry and physics, we are, I guess, plagued by that on a regular basis, right? So if you look at, I'm thinking about work I'm doing with Cliff Henderson on ordered block copolymers that align. You know, there's not aligned and unaligned. There's this continuum, and you're like, well, I don't know. And you come up with a number and say, look, when that's above one, we're calling it this. But it really does sort of approach it.
That's right.
So does that mean that there are things that are kind of in between?
Yeah. Or actually, what really reveals it is if you try to come up with a definition of life, mm-hmm. and some kind of rigorous definition of life, you're going to find it very difficult.
Okay.
You can describe life, you know, you can say it's very complicated, you can say it's self-regulating chemistry.
Right, self-reproducing, right.
Yeah, and all that, but it's anything you say about life, you can find some chemical system that does that.
So where do viruses fit in, for example?
Well, as far as the origin of life, I mean, most current models think that viruses are, number one, they're very ancient, and viruses have been part of living systems possibly since the very beginning in some kind of sense, and also that life would be impossible without them, and that evolution basically would not work as we know it without viruses. Viruses are the grease that allow evolution to work.
Okay, meaning these tiny, simple little things that can exchange genetic material.
They slop DNA all around. Yes, evolution requires...
The DNA sluts of the biological world.
That's
not what you use, because you're a respected member of the scientific community.
But they just slop DNA all around. You know, if you look at us, for example...
It's hard to swap DNA for us.
No, it isn't. Our DNA came, like our metabolism came from bacteria.
Right, and bacteria are just almost as slutty as viruses, right? They can transfer genetic material much more easily than, say, we can.
Well, I think a better way to think about it is that it's as time has gone on, as evolution has progressed, and as complexity has increased, it's increasingly difficult to swap the DNA around. You can think about it like if you had a Model T and a Model A, you can swap the generators between them. But if you have a Toyota Prius,
not even close.
Yeah. So, and biology works the same way. And you can see in the phylogenetic record that we have a very clear record that what's called horizontal gene transfer has been going slower. At one time, mm-hmm. it's very facile, and as complexity increased, it gets slower and slower and slower.
Okay.
So, and that you can, there's phylogenetic record of this, okay. So we know that for certain.
So there was a point where we had a bunch of molecules on the planet.
Yeah. And then the molecules. The interesting thing is we had many more. That's what we like to think of biology as being very complicated. Mm-hmm. But actually, in some senses, biology is very simple. If you look at the chemical diversity of, let's say, the Murchison meteorite that fell from the sky in Australia, the number of amino acids in that meteorite vastly exceeds the number of amino acids in biological systems.
Oh, and wow.
The chemical diversity in abiotic systems is higher than in biotic systems.
Oh, okay. So what you're saying is, to some degree, biology has converged.
It has sort of selected the molecules it wanted.
On which they will base these biological systems.
Yeah, and it didn't want everything. It didn't need everything. So it didn't take everything.
Okay.
And so we like to think about biology as being very complicated, but in some senses, it's very simple. I mean, all of our protein has the same backbone. We only have a limited number of amino acids.
Right.
It's actually, on some molecular ways of looking at it, biology is very, very simple compared to abiotic.
So what have we got? It's about 21 commonly used amino acids?
Yeah, 20 really, and then there's some more rare. And then there are amino acids used in metabolic processes that are not incorporated.
Right, so, into proteins on a regular basis. And we've invented new ones.
We've invented new ones. Right, but if you look at the Murchison meteorite or these chondrite meteorites that are raining down on Earth and have been for billions of years, the chemical diversity there is very, very high compared to you and me.
Okay, so what are you saying by this? You're saying that could we have gone another way?
For sure we could have gone another way. Certain things maybe were determined.
Okay.
I think, for example, protein is determined. If you evolve life anywhere I can think of reasonable in the universe, chances are it will have protein, because amino acids are so easy to make. The universe is clearly bathed with amino acids. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you look at RNA.
Right. It's a good
DNA.
System. Stick with it.
RNA and DNA, I think, is kind of an accident that if you restarted the system, you might come up with something else.
Okay. So to that end, we actually had a caller just called in with the question, why is life on Earth carbon-based? So now we're jumping way away from the upper right-hand corner of the periodic table.
Right. It's carbon-based because carbon can make many, many kinds of stable molecules, as you know.
Yeah.
And with all kinds of different geometries, you know, you have different hybridizations, SP1, SP2, SP3. You can have all kinds of geometry, and they're stable. And so it's just a great kind of little molecular, it's an atomic Lego that works really, really well, better than any other thing on the periodic table that we can think about.
Right. But I think what a lot of people do is they say, well, look, let's go down the periodic table and we'll have a similar valence in silicon. And then they did the arsenic to replace, what was it, phosphorus. Right.
Yeah.
So if you go down the periodic table, and what changes with that is bigger, more diffuse clouds of electrons that what I find in polymer chemistry can do more things. Actually, so they're not as predictable. You know, silicon-based polymers, right? Anything made out of silicone, very useful polymer. But in terms of the way you make those polymers, there are lots of other things that can happen. I mean, when you go away from carbon, do you get, too many possibilities? They're not as stable?
In the temperature range, you know, we have certain limits, what we call sort of, you know, biologically reasonable, where you have liquid water, so you have a certain temperature range we're talking about.
Right.
And then in that temperature range, do we have molecules that are thermodynamically stable or at least kinetically trapped in order to be useful? So there are kind of chemical constraints on how life can evolve. But you have to be very careful, because we live here on Earth and we look at the world around us and we try to generalize that. And you've got to be very, very careful with that, because even the idea that life is water-based, must be water-based, I have severe doubts about that you need to have water-based life.
Ooh, so could you have carbon-based life without water?
It's possible. I mean, I think if you look at Titan and some of these planets which have ocean or lakes of hydrocarbon, and I really can't see any reason why living systems could not evolve in a hydrocarbon-based liquid media.
Right, but as long as the hydrocarbons had some slightly polar things in them, wouldn't you kind of need that?
You need to have what we call molecular recognition. You need polymers. You need assembly.
Yeah.
And but you can do all that in hydrocarbon. I mean,
Well, but water has, if it really is just a hydrocarbon, they have very weak interactions, right?
Yeah, but the hydrocarbon has weak interactions. But if you think about polar molecules in the hydrocarbon, then those interactions become
yes,
very strong.
And they could be sort of smushed into, that's yeah. the technical word, into a bit of an emulsion, right? Because
yeah.
let's face it, I mean, that's just soap bubbles, right? You have an emulsion, a reverse right. emulsion. You could have life living in little vacuoles inside hydrocarbons as well.
Right. I mean, I think if you think about, to me, what happens when life evolves, you have mm-hmm. complicated small molecules, a big library of small molecules, which we know, you know, we can see from the meteors, et cetera, you know, the chondrite meteors, that's out there in the universe. And then they have to be in some kind of liquid, and then you have to have something driving polymerization and assembly. And as soon as that happens, mm-hmm. evolution goes.
Right.
I mean, I think it just goes. And so, and I don't see a need for water. As soon as you have molecules polymerizing and assembling, mm-hmm. The evolutionary processes that we can see in test tubes have got to pretty much start to work. We also think the spinning of a planet or the temperature cycling is very important because mm-hmm. you have to like do a push-pull, mm-hmm. and just cycle that back and forth.
So what do you mean by push-pull?
Well, you push things, like if you think about the spinning of the Earth, every day in your front yard you get water condensing, and yeah. every night, and then yeah. every day it evaporates.
Evaporates, right.
And so if you think about what's happening in us, we're making polymers by dehydrating, and then we're breaking them apart by hydration. So that hydration-dehydration uh-huh. cycle from the abiotic process just got cemented into okay. biology. And so we have a push. At night it pushed one way. Okay. In the day it pulled the other way, and you just go back and forth and back okay. and forth, and that became cemented into our biochemistry.
Okay, so right now you're mentioning a kind of polymer chemistry, forming big molecules, polymers. There's a lot of ways you can make polymers, right? And I'm off to the Middle East to talk to people about how to make a lot of free radical and ionic stuff using hydrocarbons, polyethylene, polypropylene. But you're talking about condensation polymers, where when the two little pieces come together to start adding segments to the polymers, water usually comes out. So
right.
a polyamide, that's a protein.
Right. Polyester.
And then,
right.
Yeah. And then, you know, when you put the water back in, then you can unbreak those and rebreak right. them and reassemble them and right. form all sorts of complicated
yeah, and
things.
If you look in biology, all of our polymers are made like that.
Yeah.
Everyone. Nucleic yeah. acid. I mean, nucleic yeah. acids are totally different from protein. But
right.
that hydration, dehydration is so intrinsic to biology.
Mm-hmm.
That and it is so mm-hmm. intrinsic to the surface of the Earth. I mean, it happens in your front yard
right.
every single day.
Right.
Hydration, dehydration, and so the physical environment got imprinted into biology, and that imprint is still there.
Ah, okay. So the point is, if we find planets with similar cycles, which is what your astrobiology right. friends discussed a few months ago, actually, when they were here
exactly.
for the conference, which was co-sponsored by your center, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and they've got some wacky stuff that's way out there.
They
so
do.
The point is, you could maybe have different temperature cycles.
And different liquids, like if
yeah,
you had
with
a hydrocarbon.
Silicon and a hydrocarbon and ammonia.
Right.
And the point is, it's possible, and we can speculate theoretically what might be there, but do we really know? I mean, isn't that
no,
why we're
we
looking?
No, we don't know.
We're looking.
That's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
That's why we want. That's why we need to go to Titan. And Enceladus, we need to go to
these moons of the planets.
And we need
in
to
our
look
system.
Out there and look at the chemistry. We don't know very much about the chemistry. We know there are polymers on Titan,
mm-hmm.
but we don't really know what they're made of. We know there's hydrocarbon lakes. We don't really know
right.
much about the chemistry.
How do we know there's polymers on Titan? I could see how we could
oh.
find out there's hydrocarbon
oh,
lakes.
Oh, from light scattering in the atmosphere.
Because you can see
it
that.
Rains polymers on Titan.
Oh, okay, so
they're
actually
in the
atmosphere.
Yeah.
So are they really big polymers?
They're reasonable sized polymers. Yeah,
okay.
I don't know by the standards of somebody who works with plastic, but they're
yeah. Because normally they don't vaporize too well.
But chemistry happens in the atmosphere. You
yeah.
get some polymers.
Yeah, we do get some.
And then it rains
some
down.
Moderate sized polymers even
yeah.
in our atmosphere. So
yeah.
absolutely. Wow. So that's totally cool.
I think there is evidence that there's kind of even dunes of some kind of material
okay.
that blows around that is people have speculated.
Yeah. So what you're saying is. The information that we get from these moons of our planets, which all comes from, you know, looking at the light that is absorbed and diffracted and reflected and all these sorts of things, is good. We've got some interesting stuff. You're saying we actually need to go there, take some samples, bring them
yeah.
back.
Well, I don't know. Taking samples back is not going to be easy, but doing the spectroscopy.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
Like what we're doing Mars right now. It's, we really can't bring anything back from Mars very easily, but we can do a lot of science there and send the data back.
Okay, exactly. So you can dig
a piece
of
Earth. We can have one of those
Earth,
rovers on Titan. Oh, my God.
And just do a big chunk of everything from infrared to plasma and resonance, and you learn all about different types of stuff that's on
all
there.
Kinds of microscopy and X-ray diffraction. And
All right, so then the
interest. You guys had a caller question.
Okay.
It was, they said, you guys are saying polymers and talking about polymers a lot. Can you better explain what polymers are and what you're talking about?
Would you like to begin, Lauren?
Well, I'll begin. I'm a biochemist, so I study a very small subset of polymers, which are biological polymers. Basically, those are, you can think of them like beads on a string. They're, you have what we call monomers, which are like maybe amino acids, and then they string together to form these very long molecules that in biology are generally unbranched. Not always, but and they can be very, very long, and they can fold into very complicated and very specific three-dimensional structures, which is how we get enzymes, and all of our functionality comes from polymers. And I think if we study, if we think about living systems, there is an assumption that polymers are required. You need polymers to have complicated information.
Mm-hmm. So it's a big string of molecules that lets you turn into certain shapes?
Yeah, that folds to have certain function. Shapes.
Yes, there are sort of certain kinds of, like if you think about DNA, DNA just forms a polymer and it doesn't really have a very interesting shape, but it's for information storage. So it's like a computer tape, which you don't really want wrinkled up into some specific shape.
It coils
shape.
Up in a very compact way, right? Because we think of this double helix, but then the double helix not only forms that coil, but it's super coils. Very, very complicated.
Right.
Whereas RNA, which is something you study a lot, and we've actually done some work with you, and I need to talk to you about that.
We got a paper we got to get up.
RNA is a lot more floppy. RNA can do a lot
more
interesting
things. Yeah, but it can fold into more interesting three-dimensional shapes.
So it's like a group of the same molecule a bunch of times that turns into a shape that's useful for something?
Yeah, the same repeating. Okay.
Same.
In fact, Trent, you were laughing at me one day when I was trying to explain the structure of a protein that I got so complicated. That
you did.
You were ready to
get very complicated very
blunt,
fast when you talk about chemistry.
A blunt object.
Well, I can say DNA has four kinds of monomers.
So DNA is a polymer?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a polymer of CGAT. And
since it's a double helix, that makes it a polymer.
No.
Or no, the CGAT make it a polymer, but then it folds into a double helix.
And two polymers come together in self-complementary sequence, and that makes the polymer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes a double helix.
DNA.
But each one of those strands is a polymer.
Right.
So when you're talking about Titan, it could have a different polymer that could form something like DNA because it's a different structure.
It could be, or protein, or it might be an uninteresting polymer, but it... Definitely, you know, all polymers are not equally interesting.
Yeah, many of the polymers I study are not as interesting as your polymers. So, for example, protein is a polyamide, and the best example that our caller can probably relate to is nylon. Nylon's a polyamide. And in nylon...
That's the best example of a... Okay, that hurts me.
Why is that a...
There's like hemoglobin...
No, what I'm saying is on the synthetic side. And on the synthetic side, we take only one or two types of monomers and we glue those together. And they have the same kind of, you know, carbon double bonded oxygen nitrogen link. And when you put those things together, they spit out water. But nylon is relatively simple, so it doesn't do the cool things that proteins do. Proteins have a very specific sequence of 21 or so amino acids that are commonly used. And by putting, you know, ones that like water, ones that hate water, ones that are negatively charged, you can get them to fold into really neat things that will do cool stuff.
That's exactly right.
Nylon is something that David Koo, one of our colleagues over in bioengineering, likes to call a dumb plastic. But even nylon's pretty good because parts of nylon will crystallize and form this rigid sort of strong part. And then parts of nylon will be non-crystalline, very flexible. And the interesting thing is nylon is on a very basic level similar to silk, which is a protein. And nylon was the first thing used to create a lightweight but very strong fiber, which is how silk works. So there's a reason why it works so well doing that sort of thing.
But I want to just... make sure we understand the difference between nylon and real protein.
And hit it.
Because that goes right to the core of what is biology, which is that protein has 20 different monomers. That's like you could say 20 different colored beads on your necklace.
Yeah.
And biology has ways of encoding the specific ordering of those beads. Mm-hmm. And that's called coding. And in fact, if you want to come up with a definition of life, it is the encoding of information on a truly molecular level. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we don't see anywhere, maybe in abiotic chemistry or even in biotechnology.
Yeah, it is very rare. And the information is not nearly as complicated.
Right. And also the what we call the information transduction. What we have is we have information stored in DNA, mm-hmm. and then that's easily converted to RNA. But that's one kind of polymer with a certain kind of backbone and certain kind of side chains. And then we can transduce that into protein sequence. And that's a totally different kind of polymer with totally different backbone and side chains and different properties. And that information transduction between really different kinds of polymers mm-hmm. is really the core of life. That's what distinguishes, if you want to say chemically, that's how life is different from non-life.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the all this signal and information transduction that you're talking about is literally sort of the recording and transfer of this information, like what you do in the digital age with a DVD or a CD.
Exactly.
And life, life, extremely precise and accurate, very few mistakes.
Right, and also that part of life is essentially exactly the same in everything alive. It is the same in you and your dog and bacteria and archaea. That is the part. People talk about diversity in life, and you know, you have giraffes and hippopotamuses, but actually once you strip away all of it and look at that core, the information transduction machinery,
right.
It's all bogus because it's all the same. I mean, life is actually everywhere the
same. And in contrast, if you want to talk about diversity, the plastic bag that's the low-density polyethylene you get when you go to the grocery store, every one of those polymers is different. But on average, they have exactly the same properties. We don't know how to make the little branches exact every third one. If we do, that would have amazing properties. And maybe that's what we should talk about when we come back.
Right.
The fact that, you know, maybe if instead of encoding these protein polyamides, we encoded polyesters like the ones that go in your water bottle, could we do amazing things?
I think we could.
All right. So let's talk about that when we come back. We'll take a quick break, but we'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. Keep it simple. Tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
You know who you are. You know you have a problem. How it's all slipping away under your feet like quicksand into an agonizing vortex of lies and pain and stupidity. You know, life. Life sucks, and we understand. We're the Church of the Subgenius, and we're here with proven therapies that can help you survive your daily hell march by giving you the ability to laugh in the face of the horror. Indeed, to laugh your guts out. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse deliver a solid two-hour dose of psychic medication to armor you against the deadly friction of your everyday existence. That's midnight Saturdays on WREK Atlanta. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse from the Church of the Subgenius. We don't know exactly what we are, but we know for sure that we're not them.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta, where today we're talking with Lauren Williams from the NASA Center for Ribosomal Origins and Evolution on the origin of life. And we're really getting into the chemical nature of it. And Trent, we've got a caller. Hey, welcome to the program. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, how do you get mutations? In other words, trees are supposed to millions of years ago are now have been turned into coal or oil because there was nothing to eat them. So how did they evolve to something that now eats them?
Okay, so are we talking about the evolution of trees? Because trees have
No. How do you get a mutation? How do you end up with a bacteria or a fungus or something that will now eat the cellulose, whereas you didn't have it millions of years ago?
Okay, so yeah, specific functionality. Good question.
Okay, yeah, I mean, so it's actually more than just mutations. I mean, people like to think about change as happening gradually and being by mutation, and so mutations happen. Because in any molecular system, there are fluctuations, et cetera. There's all kinds of...
Can I say mistakes sometimes?
Mistakes, yes. Yeah. Polymerases make mistakes. So when biology copies DNA, there's a certain frequency that mistakes are made. And these mistakes are not good. And so there are what are called proofreading enzymes, and there's repair enzymes, and there's a lot of work that your body does in order to correct these mistakes. But still, the mistakes get made. And also... you chemically damage your DNA if you smoke cigarettes or if you let sunshine on you. All sorts of chemistry happens to DNA. And then once that happens, when the DNA is replicated, then, of course, the mistake rate goes way up, much higher, because, of course, the polymerases have a hard time with chemically modified DNA. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But also, if you think about viruses and genetic transfer, a lot of, you know, your DNA is not really... always what you were born with, because you have viruses that integrate DNA into your genome. You have all sorts of DNA slopping around. And so in biology, you have entire, even metabolic systems that have moved from one place to another at certain points in evolution. So there's a lot of mechanisms that DNA can change.
And that's
change.
Sort of the chemical explanation of it, but the way we see it manifested is on a sort of a bigger, long-term, global type of thing where you'll get a mutation, and oftentimes the mutation results in just killing the organism, right?
Yeah. You know, or a lot of mutations diseases. Do nothing.
Yeah, or do nothing, because sometimes if that's on the real inside of the protein that isn't involved in the function of the protein, you'll never notice it.
That's right.
So that's an interesting theory, that mutations sort of occur at a constant rate. And people always wonder, why doesn't change occur at a constant rate? Because a lot of these mutations, or at least this is what Richard Dawkins argues in his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, which, by the way, we reviewed about a month ago. So you can go back in our archives at insidetheblackbox.org and check those. But what will happen is every once in a while you'll get a mutation that says, look, this enzyme can break down a highly crystalline polysaccharide a little better than the more amorphous sugars like starches. Cellulose is that really crystalline one. And it started by random, but if that organism can eat wood better than starches, and there's a lot of wood around and not a lot of starches, they will reproduce and thrive, and boom, you get the bacteria that exists in the gut of the termite or something like
that. We call that conferring advantage.
Yes,
so
exactly.
If you have a mutation that confers advantage, then there will be selective pressure to propagate and maintain that mutation.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
So you get back to your quorum that you talked about last week or the week before?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to do with quorum sensing. That's a very high-level bacterial behavior. But I guess what Lauren's saying is at some point, chemically, you had a mistake or a miscommunication that resulted in different behavior. And if the different behavior then is good, meaning lots of wood to eat, not a lot of starches to eat, that, you know, microorganism or small, simple organism will thrive and grow much more with successive generations.
Yeah, you know what? There's a good example of this is there is a mutation in hemoglobin. It's a single point mutation that causes sickle cell...
one nucleotide that's changed.
Makes one amino acid change in the hemoglobin protein, and that causes sickle cell anemia. And that's generally considered a deleterious mutation, except there are certain situations where that actually confers advantage. So the reason it will depend on environment and all sorts of things. So mutations are, we don't talk about good and bad. We just talk about conferring advantage. Mm-hmm. And the advantage depends on all sorts of things, you know, whether in the environment. So, for example, whether the sickle cell anemia mutation confers advantage or not is dependent on environment. Actually, it's dependent on certain infectious diseases, et cetera.
Right.
So there are some, so that's where that comes from. But you can think about that in general. That if a mutation confers advantage, it will be selected for.
Right. But the point is the mutation itself is a chemical tweak.
Absolutely.
Right.
And we know chemically pretty much what the mechanisms of mutation are, and we know pretty right. much how they're manifest.
Yeah. But with regard to how it manifests itself in that global thing, believe it or not, Dawkins' book, The Greatest Show on Earth, actually is a really good educational book about evolution. I actually learned a lot about it when I read it, so I would recommend that.
But, so you're saying that evolution is, or this change is always going on, and it's going on throughout the universe.
Well, it's through the. Well, it might not be going on the moon because, there, as far as we know, nothing is alive on the moon. So no, I would say it's not going on everywhere in the universe, but it's everywhere there is life. I would say yes, there has to be something certainly going on. Everything alive on Earth is, you know, your DNA or. I mean, you could say our gene pool, the human gene pool, is constantly changing. It's changing mm-hmm. over time. And as selective pressure changes, you know, the selective pressure on us is different than it was on our ancestors a couple thousand years ago or 100,000 years ago. So our gene pool is definitely changing over time. And with microbes, you know, think about bacteria and antibiotics. So we are applying selective pressure to bacterial populations. And so those bacterial populations are changing their genetic makeup in response to that.
Okay. Well, right. Thank you very much.
All right. Great sure. question. Sure. Thank you. Yeah, so last week we were actually talking about quorum sensing in bacteria. And one of the pressures we put on the changes in your gut bacteria are antibiotics. Yeah. So that's a big deal. All right. Trent's giving me the you're always pushing us for time.
So we have to go? We're done.
Well, all right, so let me get back to this polyester thing really quick.
Okay. You love polyester.
Well, so I like the fact that you claim that, you know, things were different, right? And if you could, I mean, do you actually believe we could get RNA-like molecules to polymerize polyesters instead of polyamides?
Oh, we could do that. In fact, the ribosome, which is where proteins
yeah,
is
where
made,
they get made right.
You don't have to make too big a change, and it will make polyester for you. That's been done. That was done in 1978.
Okay, so people can throw, instead of amino acids, these would be hydroxy acids, right?
Exactly.
The public knows as fruit acids, and they put them in cosmetics, and they're supposed to get rid of wrinkles, and I'm not sure they do, but my wife slashes this stuff all over her face. They can actually get them to polymerize that?
Yeah, definitely.
Right,
if you charge tRNAs with hydroxy acids,
okay.
you can run them through the ribosome and you can make polyester.
So the point is the suggestion you made to me a while ago about doing some models of some highly regular polyesters might not be a bad idea.
Yeah.
So we should
absolutely. It's technically doable.
Oh, okay.
You give me $5 million, okay. I could make coated polyester.
Okay.
In 3 years.
And then hopefully with much less money than that, I can tell you which ones you want to make.
Okay, yeah, that would be helpful.
Yeah, and the truth is, we talked about these dumb plastics before. There are a very few polymers that are synthetic polymers that we make that do form helices. They do form interesting structures. And we speculate about if we could do that as well as Mother Nature does, man, we could make some really cool materials.
We could. Potential
so
is unbelievable.
Can you do me one more thing before we get out here? And that is, you talked about this chemical or molecular fossil. What exactly
yeah.
is that?
Well, basically, those are molecules that are in us that have been replicated over billions of years without change.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have molecules, actually, that date from the origin of life that are older than life. And those, in fact, amino acids, for example, have been replicated mm-hmm. in biology, but they were taken originally from abiotic systems.
Mm-hmm.
And then the original, let's say, backbone, let's say the protein backbone, which was probably established about 3.9 billion years ago,
mm-hmm.
and then it has not changed since. So there's many things in biology which we call molecular fossils, which are really older than we can imagine. I mean, they're older than what we think of as biology. They really, so we have these fossils of mm-hmm. their molecules, but they are very, very ancient, and they allow us to understand the origin of life because that's where they come from. And they've been maintained for us, just like you can study dinosaurs by looking at mineral mm-hmm. fossils. We can study the origin of life by looking at molecular
fossils. But when you
fossils.
Think about fossils, you look at fossils and the fossil is different.
It's,
than yeah. what it is today.
Right. It's been replaced atom per atom or molecule per molecule. So there's sort of an imprint of the original there. So yes, it's not the same atom.
Can you actually find the protein that has similar structure, that has similar function but different structure?
That's exactly what we're working on. We think in something called the ribosome, there's these what we call these protein tails, mm-hmm. which are polypeptide, but we think they are fossils of a pre-protein polymer that mm-hmm. is older than protein. In fact, we think it was partly ester. So we have so we definitely think we are seeing this fossilization process, and we're using that to infer the previous molecules that were there.
So what you're saying is when we first started, maybe not everything was a polyamide, like a protein.
It might have been polyesters. It was a mix. We think it was actually heterogeneous amides, esters, racemate, what we call racemate, left-handed, right-handed. It was pretty messy.
Okay, so this kind of freaky molecule that maybe was the beginning of something that could both catalyze things and store and transfer information, which now we have separate things doing, right? I mean, we've kind of got DNA and RNA that store and transfer, and then we have proteins that catalyze. Right. And you kind of need both, but what you, and I think Nick Hudd has mentioned this before, we had to start with one really cool molecule.
But not one, but one family.
One type.
That was, because we believe it was actually sort of a mixture.
Okay, so, all right, let me see if I can summarize this rambling chaos that we have created here today. Basically, the interesting thing that I've realized is that life is actually simple, right?
Yeah,
if you think about it,
in
life,
my view. And the origin of life is simple.
Right? Chemistry is complicated, but chemistry, which has great diversity, when it sort of finds a particular, what do I want to say, path, then things actually get much simpler because they sort of coalesce around that.
There's a convergence, yes, actually.
Yeah, definitely. And in a sense, on the macroscopic level, there is a convergence as well, right? We have certain classes of animals, and we've converged, whereas, you know, if you just look at bacteria and maybe simpler animals, we probably had a greater diversity, and now we've gone down these parts.
Right, but we are not as different from a bacterium as we like to think.
No, I don't think we are.
I mean, our DNA, the backbones are the same. There's, you know, sugars are the same. The ribosomes at the core are the same. I mean, that convergence happened, and it happened a long time ago. And the diversity we see is kind of an illusion. It's on the surface.
Okay. So basically what you're saying is, and let me use the silicon analogy, that if you think about it, we have all these different computers and all these different devices, and they all do different things, amazingly different things. But they really are just a bunch of transistors all arranged in a slightly different way. On the molecular level, that's really what they look like.
Right. Yes. Or you could say all the cars and trucks on the highway, they all have internal combustion engines. Yeah. Although now they don't. But
okay.
But 10 years ago,
only,
they did.
You know, the hybrids and the things like
Excluding
that.
Excluding all that.
Okay.
Underneath the hood, they're not so different.
Okay. And maybe part of the reason for this diversity eventually converging would be what the DNA slots of the biological
phages world. And viruses.
Phages and viruses, right? Just simple chunks of DNA sort of encapsulated is maybe the best
way
to
think about that. They can slop around and invade and integrate.
Okay. And evidence for that diversity we find on meteorites, that there's a lot more amino acids there.
Yeah. And those are raining down on us as we speak.
Right. And there's plenty of and basically your definition of life is saying the ability to encode information in molecules like polymers.
And I also think to transduce it between sort of disparate polymer types.
Ah, okay.
That's, I think, a key, which is called translation. In biology, that is called translation.
Okay. So basically have the RNA take its information from the DNA and send it into the ribosome and make
protein.
It into a protein.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Which is something we don't necessarily do with synthetic polymers, although that would be cool. And maybe that's something we ought to be looking at. Wow. All right. So anything else I missed?
I think you covered it.
That's a good definition of life, though, but it doesn't match the chapter 2 definition my son's 7th grade textbook.
That's my definition.
Okay. But it is much better. All right. So, Lauren, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks, Pete. And nice to be here, everybody.
And if any of our listeners have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Trent Altman is our chief engineer. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology, which is actually restored back to the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. We were Google for the past week.
That's right.
I think they've taken down most of the signs.
They took all those colorful umbrellas and bicycles away.
Right, for the Vince Vaughn, Owen Wilson film, The Intern. I'll be looking forward to that.
It looked good for a while.
All right. But please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.